What I'm going to discuss follows up, of course, on what Michael has just presented. I'm not going to be adding much or hardly anything new to conceptual issues, but what I'm going to do is extend this to fields. The idea was that one of the issues that was pointed out in the meeting that would be of interest is to see how these ideas can connect to gravity. And it turns out that we can connect to gravity and make some remarks about it. And I want to show you what that is and how it works. And for this, then, I will be looking at fields. I will be emphasizing some things a bit differently from Michael for pedagogical reasons, just easier. I will be emphasizing more the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, even though I agree with Michael that one of the strengths of this approach is that it puts probabilities in the spotlight. But as I say, to show the development in 45 minutes or less, then I will be presenting in a slightly different way. In the talk, I'll first discuss a little bit the motivation for doing this. I will use as an example electromagnetism. And after that, I will go to gravitational fields. And one thing that I will discuss as a, say, a new door that opens with this approach is the coupling of a classical gravitational field to quantum fields and see how that turns out. And I will give an example where you can actually work out a solution in MIDI superspace. And then I'll finish with some remarks. So some motivation for doing this, as Michael explained, once you have a formalism like this, you would like to explore the limitations, see how far you can go in different directions. And one thing we did was explore the possibility of looking at quantum field theory. And the question is which type of fields you can handle with this formalism. And as Michael explained, if you have a formulation where the kinetic energy is of a quadratic type, then you can add the fluctuations just like you did in the classical case. In the classical case, you get a Schrodinger equation. In this case, you get a functional Schrodinger equation. And you can reproduce the quantization of electromagnetic field, and you can get the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, for example. What is, I guess, of interest to see conceptually, how does this differ from standard ways of quantizing? And in particular, how does this differ when you come to gravity? And finally, as I said, I will look at the issue of coupling quantum matter to a classical gravitational field and discuss that a bit more in detail. So these are all motivations for going in this direction. And as I said, I thought it was appropriate for this meeting to discuss a little bit these issues. As you saw from Michael's presentation, we are working in configuration space. And we essentially, at the classical level, at least working on with the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And this means that when we go to field theory, the language that is adequate for that, for the classical fields, is a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of the theory. And this is not necessarily that familiar, so I want to make just a few remarks about Hamilton-Jacobi equation. What I want to stress here is that the Hamilton-Jacobi equation stands on its own. That is, we usually learn about it first in the context of a Hamiltonian formalism as a way of doing canonical transformations, so on and so forth. But it can be derived from an action by just doing a particular type of variational principle that is well known, in which you not only vary the paths with a fixed endpoint, but also vary the endpoints. And what you get when you do that and require the variation to be zero is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. I want to emphasize this point because when it comes to looking at the quantum theories, I would like you to forget in a sense that there is a Hamiltonian formalism and that the standard way of quantizing is to go through the Hamiltonian formalism, replace the Poisson brackets by operators and build your Hilbert space and so on and so forth. In this approach here, we bypass this procedure. And this gives you some a little bit more freedom, in a sense, when you're doing the quantization. Whether it really gives you something new or not, that's an open question. And I'll ask a couple of questions to the audience about whether one can get a bit more this way than if you go the standard way. The point is here again, your function S is a function of configuration space variables. We remain in configuration space. We don't go to a phase space. How does this work for the electromagnetic field? Let me show you first how you get a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of the electromagnetic field. This is standard material that was of interest some decades ago and now doesn't seem to be of that much interest, but if you go to Mr. Thorne and Wheeler, chapter 21, you see these equations, and I went that, so I wanted to be sure I got the factor of pi correct. So if they're wrong, it's their fault. So what do you do? You start with your standard Lagrangian density, where your F mu nu is defined in this way, as usual. And then just as I showed you before with the classical variational principle, if you carry out this variational principle here with the fields, then you get the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And this is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation for the electromagnetic field. And in this case, here we see the magnetic field. The momenta component is the electric part of the electromagnetic field. And invariants under gauge transformations come into the formalism in a very neat way. This Lagrangian is invariant under adding a gradient here to A, as well known. And the way to impose this invariance is to say, well, what happens to S when I do one of these transformations? That's expressed by this expression here. Basically, the change in S is going to be the function of the derivative of S with respect to A multiplied by the change in A. And if you replace this quantity here by this gradient and do an integration by parts, and then say I could have used any arbitrary function lambda, then you get an expression of this sort. And this essentially gives you the conditions for satisfying this gauge invariant. And what you have here then is you have a configuration space for the theory, which is A1, A2, and A3. A0 doesn't play a role. And S has to satisfy this condition. So any S that satisfies this condition is a gauge invariant quantity, and then that's electromagnetism from the point of view of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Now, I just wrote down here again the same equations I had before, just to have them there. Once you have this Hamilton-Jacobi equation, you can then introduce an ensemble Hamiltonian. And as I was pointing out before, Michael emphasized the probability aspect of it. I'm just doing a shortcut here and just starting from the Hamilton-Jacobi equation and going into this ensemble. And what you need to do then is introduce a probability density over the space of the field, and introduce some appropriate ensemble Hamiltonian. And what you want, of course, is something that's going to reproduce your Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And this will be a condition that you assume as an auxiliary condition. It turns out that for consistency reasons, you're going to impose the same condition on your probabilities. And the one that does the job is pretty straightforward to read it. You just multiply this by P. And now you have an integral over space and over the function integral over the field. And this you only really need because you want to have a variational principle for the field. And it has to have some properties because you want to be able to integrate by parts. But it's not very, very crucial as far as deriving the equation of motions. And if you do the variations, then you get the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And you get a continuity equation. So you have the classical theory that you had before, and you've extended to ensembles. And the only condition you want to preserve is that your probability is conserved. Okay. That's you want to impose that. And this gives you then the classical ensemble of gravitational fields, of electromagnetic fields in configuration space. Then to do the quantization using the approach that Michael described, what you do really, you follow the same steps that Michael did. You say, I'm going to assume that I can add this non-classical fluctuations I'm going to impose independence, I'm going to impose exact uncertainty, so on and so forth. What comes out of that is then this, that you have to add an additional term to your classical Lagrangian, which is this Fisher information type of term. And then if you take this Hamiltonian and do a canonical transformation to the wave function representation, then you get your usual Schrödinger functional equation for the electromagnetic field. And you have, of course, this auxiliary constraint. So this is how it works for electromagnetism. You don't get much that's new as far as the mathematics, but it's quite nice that it goes through and that you can use this formalism. What you get new is a somewhat different picture of what you did by going to this quantum theory. One thing that I stress is that because of the mathematical language we're using, we get quantum field theory in the functional Schrödinger representation, which is fine. It's, it has had a bit of a revival since there were some papers which showed that you can do almost pretty much everything that you can do with other representations. The way the electromagnetic, the electric and magnetic field relate to A, of course, is this way, and here we have that the momenta is E. And the physical picture you have here is that what you're doing is you're adding non-classical fluctuations to the electric field. Because as I said, when you do this exact uncertainty approach, you add fluctuations to ds, to the partial functional derivative of s. And the exact uncertainty that Michael discussed in this case corresponds to the fact that the strength of the fluctuations that you add here are determined by the uncertainty in the magnetic field components. So the way Michael showed for the particle system, you add fluctuations to P depending on the probability distribution of X. And here you have something similar, except that now you have this probability defined over essentially the magnetic field. What I want to stress here is that, again, there is no need to go through a canonical formalism to get these results. And this gives you some freedom when you look at the case of gravity. Of course, one still needs to do some further reconstruction. That is, we only have the functional Schrödinger equation. We would like to have more. But as Michael pointed out, once you have the functional Schrödinger equation, you have linearity, you can go in and reconstruct all the things. So there's some technical issues. The measure of the space of field is not a big complication. There's a lot of work done on this coming from Feynman type of approach. And as I said, the only thing you need to measure for here, if you want to derive the equation of motion, is to be able to have a variational principle and be able to do integration by parts, basically. You need these assumptions for quantization, and these are essentially the same assumptions that Michael discussed when he was talking about the Schrödinger equation. The only thing that's a bit trickier is that the non-classical term that you add to the Hamiltonian then depends on this covariance matrix and just handling the mathematics of this and doing all the showing that you get a term of this sort from these assumptions. It's just technically more complicated than for the particle case. But conceptually, it all goes through. So this is the picture that you get when you translate this into a field theory. And what I would like to do now is see how this plays out if you go to gravity. There, we should be able to do this because we have a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation, and it's quadratic in the momenta, so the recipe goes through. I will work in the metric representation the whole time, but if you go to the connection representation, to abstract variables, there you also have a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation, and there it also is quadratic in the momenta. So in principle, you can also work in the abstract variables. In the way it works for gravity, you have what's usually called the Einstein-Hamilton-Jacobi equation. It is of this form. And in the Hamiltonian formulation of the theory, you have four constraints, three momenta constraints. And when you go to the Hamilton-Jacobi theory, the momenta constraints are just telling you that the covariant derivative of this quantity vanishes. And this is just the, it's equivalent to saying that my functional S is invariant under coordinate transformation. So it's a very simple interpretation of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And one can then just work with this equation here and just make sure that you keep track of this constraint. So whenever you define an S, you have to define it as a functional that's invariant under coordinate transformation. So an integral of anything that, that's well formulated will do the job. And as I say, since we have the Einstein-Hamilton-Jacobi equation, I take that as my starting point. The first thing I will do is I'll go to the classical ensembles of gravitational fields. And in this case, I will, it's straightforward to define an ensemble Hamiltonian. It's analogous to the case for electromagnetism. You just multiply then by the probability density, and this defines your ensemble Hamiltonian. One thing I forgot to mention, which plays a role later, I've written this Einstein-Hamilton-Jacobi equation as an integral over a lattice function n here. And this function n is arbitrary. So this means that we could forget about the integral and we get essentially an infinite number of equations, one for each point x. But I will keep it this way because when you look for solutions of these equations, it turns out convenient not to look for a general solution that satisfies this gauge invariance for some particular solution. So I'm writing it like this. Another thing that I forgot to mention, the configuration space is the set of three metrics. So you have a hypersurface and you define the metrics on this hypersurface, and that's your configuration space. Yeah? Okay, n appears in the Hamiltonian formulation as a Lagrange multiplier. And n is, from the physics point of view, is the lattice function, which tells you how to move from one hypersurface to the next in, as you evolve in time. It's not the whole thing because basically if you have two hypersurfaces, you can move up but also a little bit to the side. And then the movement to the side are given by three other functions that enter into the momentum. But for now, you can just think of this as any function, basically. And what you can think of this equation as some sort of a smeared out type of equation, saying that you think of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation as something that you integrate with respect to a test function. And no matter what test function you choose, it has to be zero. That's one way to look at it. Yeah? Not necessarily, not in the case of classical ensembles. In the case of classical ensembles,
because it appears to be a probability of a particular space geometry. And that's probability in instance of time?
Yes, but in the classical case you can reconstruct the full space-time. I'll show you how that is done. When you go to the quantum case, then that's an open question what it is that you can do. But in the classical case, it turns out it doesn't look like it. The Hamilton-Jacobi equation, the formulation has four equations here, and you need 10 for the Einstein equation. But it turns out that you can get the other six equations. This was done in the late 60s by Gerlach, I think. Yeah. And it's a rather complicated paper, but in this formalism, it comes out in a very straightforward way, just one step, basically. So I'll show you how that works here. But you're right, your configuration space is the set of metrics on a hypersurface, and that's what we have here. Now, if you take this ensemble Hamiltonian, then you get these equations if you put in the restriction that the derivative with respect to an external time is equal to zero. Okay, and this is well known from this totally constrained systems that you don't have time in the formalism. It just drops out. It disappears. And that you can see already here from this Einstein-Hamilton-Jacobi equation. But there's no time derivative of S. So this has to be brought in as a condition that gives you the correct equation. And what you get again is the Hamilton-Jacobi equation here. And here you get what you can interpret as a continuity equation. So this gives you a generalization, if you may, of the Einstein theory. And what is interesting is if you assume, if you want to interpret this as a continuity equation, then this term here has to essentially behave like a velocity. Okay? Otherwise, you don't have a continuity equation. And that means that the time derivative of your metric here has to be linear in this quantity here. That also means then that any time evolution of your tree metric, you can write it in this form. This first term here comes from assuming that the time derivative is linear in this part here. And the second term here comes from the fact that you have invariance of the probabilities with respect to spatial coordinate transformation. So you can always do a spatial coordinate transformation and change this a little bit according to this type of gauge transformation here. And what's nice here is that this is a set of six equations, and they are the six Einstein equations that we're missing. So the interpretation of this as a continuity equation gives you then the missing Einstein equations. And this sort of makes sense because Hamilton-Jacobi theories are really theories of ensembles. You have a velocity, you have a vector field in your configuration space, and you can consider probability distribution. And in the case of the proof by Gerlach, essentially it uses the same idea, but he doesn't introduce explicitly a probability distribution, and therefore it's a rather long proof. But this comes right away that you get the six Einstein equations. So this is quite nice because it shows that the formalism does give you something that you don't get in the usual way of looking at the Einstein-Hamilton-Jacobi equation. The way you quantize, again, is the same way that was done with the electromagnetic field. If you apply these axioms that Michael introduced, and if you look at this case here, then you get additional term that is, again, a Fisher information type of term. And now you have the Wheeler-DeWitt metric here. And what's interesting here is that when you carry out the variational principle, you get the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But in our formalism, you get a specific ordering for this operator here. So this is a sandwich type of ordering that comes out of the formalism. So it gives you the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with a particular choice of ordering. And this is, first of all, it's quite nice that you can get the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in this way. And if you follow the approach, then you can go a bit further and try to understand what is going on. And if you think of in terms of the geometry, then this quantity here, which is essentially the momenta, is the extrinsic curvature tensor of your space-time. So if we want to do something analogous to what was done with the electromagnetic case, what we have here is that we're adding non-classical fluctuations to the extrinsic curvature tensor. And the strength of these fluctuations then depend on the probability distribution of the spatial metric. So this is sort of in a physical sense what is going on when we apply the exact uncertainty approach to gravitational fields. Yeah?
Why didn't you get the time derivative in the
Wheeler-DeWitt
equation?
There isn't a time derivative in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation.
That's right, but why isn't there one in your formalism?
Yeah, I've done the following. If you have a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of a theory that's invariant under coordinate transformations, it's known that you don't get a time derivative of S. That's in a paper by Bergman from 66 or so. I've assumed that the same holds true for P, otherwise I will get inconsistencies. And it is because I'm assuming that that when I do this variation of principle, I also get a timeless equation. Yeah. Now, one can compare this to other stochastic theories of gravity. For example, in stochastic gravity, the starting point is a semi-classical approximation where you couple the energy momentum tensor, the expectation value of a quantum energy momentum tensor to the Einstein equations. And to go beyond that, what is done is people add fluctuations to this term. So in this case, the energy momentum tensor, in the case of stochastic gravity. Here it's somewhat different in that we are adding fluctuations to the extrinsic curvature tensor. So the two theories are fundamentally different in that sense. Now, here's where one might be getting something new, or one might be making a mistake. And it comes to this issue here. It's tempting to say, well, in the classical case, if I look at the continuity equation, I can get the rate equations and the remaining six Einstein equations from this continuity equation. In the case where I've quantized, I'm adding a fluctuation to this quantity here. That is, I'm adding a fluctuation to the extrinsic curvature, to the momenta. So maybe it makes sense to introduce evolution equations for the field that are stochastic and replace the classical case by adding a stochastic field here that has to obey the exact uncertainty conditions that it scales in the proper way and whatnot. If this makes sense, then this would bring in an intrinsic type of time into the quantum theory, which is missing at the moment. For example, talking about time, that is an extrinsic time that we need. And this will be a little voice that says it's 1730, you're in foliation number 25. But it's tempting to explore this, and I haven't looked at the consequences of really doing this. It's a complicated thing to calculate because you have the stochastic equations here. Another thing that is striking here is that since you are quantizing in a way that bypasses the Hamiltonian formulation, the question arises, do you really have to worry about Dirac consistency? That is, one of the difficult problems of quantization of gravity is that you go to an algebra of constraints in the Hamiltonian formulation. This algebra of constraints has to do with the fact that you have foliations and that you can go from one foliation to the other, and you have the invariance and the coordinate transformation, whatnot. But when you go from the classical theory to the quantum theory, you have to preserve this Dirac algebra. And that's very difficult to do, and that causes a lot of problems. Here it would be tempting to say, well, we never went into a Hamiltonian formulation. We never even built a classical phase space. Maybe we don't have to worry about that. It sounds too good to be true. So I don't know what the status of this question is, really. This is an open question that one has to consider, whether this baggage that you have to carry when you do canonical quantization for gravity is also in here but hidden in some strange way, or whether you don't really have to worry about it because you didn't introduce this to begin with. As I say, these are two open questions, but one can explore them in this formalism. One thing that remains, of course, are all the usual difficulties of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. After all, what we get in the end is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So it's something that is very difficult to solve and to handle, and that, of course, remains. the last thing I want to discuss about new vistas that open when you use this approach with respect to gravity is the possibility of coupling quantum fields to a classical gravitational field. As Michael pointed out, in the case of particles, we can show that we have a consistent formulation of mixed classical and quantum theories. And Michael showed some applications to measurement theory. But you can also apply it to other cases. And one case which is of interest is to try to say, well, what would happen if I try to, if gravity remains a classical field and only the matter fields are quantized? Do I get a consistent theory? Do I get any predictions? Can I solve the equations? And there's several reasons for doing that. One would like to know if it's possible, if you come up with something that's reasonable or not. The other thing is that it would be interesting as an intermediary step to a full theory of gravity to have this ability. That is, if this breaks down, we would like to know where it breaks down and why, and in which way the quantum theory can fix it. And it should give us some clue on how to get to a quantum theory. And if it doesn't break down, then we know that we're in a situation like the electromagnetic field. There's a famous paper of Bohr and Rosenfeld where they show that it's consistent to quantize the electromagnetic field, but they don't prove that you have to do it. That comes from experiment. And it might be we might be in a similar situation where it's only when we have experimental data that we find out that we have to quantize the electromagnetic field, the gravitational field. But to know that, we need a theory where we can couple a classical gravitational field to quantum matter. And there have been claims in the literature that there's no sense in bringing in a quantized gravitational field. Dyson recently has argued that there's no way to measure gravitons, and that has convinced him that the gravitational field is classical. If this were to be the case, then one would have to move to a description of this sort. So it's interesting for these reasons. It's also interesting to, again, to look at the limitations of a reconstruction of quantum theory like the one that we're discussing here. So how do you do that? I described this for the case of taking a quantized scalar field and a classical gravitational field. Again, you can start with ensemble Hamiltonian. This gives you the classical equation. This is for the classical case. It will give you the classical equations of motion, the Hamilton-Jacobi equation of the coupled system and a continuity equation. And the particular form is of this sort. And what you need to do, again, is add a Fisher information term to the ensemble Hamiltonian, but one that only adds fluctuations to the scalar field. That is, you don't add a Fisher term that adds fluctuations to the gravitational field. And you end up with a hybrid system. And again, what is happening is that you're adding fluctuations to the momenta of the quantum field, but not to gravity. And one thing that is important is that since you have a theory of ensembles, you can consider the case where you have uncertainty in the state of the gravitational field. And that seems to be a crucial ingredient, because you cannot couple a state that has uncertainty to a state that has no uncertainty. It's not going to work. So you have to allow the possibility that both classical and quantum have the same type of description, common mathematical framework, and that the classical field is represented by a probability distribution of the field. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, so if you have a classical background in the field in a couple of way, do you still get the results from the inflation, or the long fluctuations actually manifest themselves as gravitational fluctuations?
I don't know. I haven't done that calculation, so one would have to see.
What I'm asking is a question. I wasn't expecting to do that calculation, but what I'm wondering is, do the quantum fluctuations influence the background?
Yeah. There is a back reaction. Yeah, and that is an important aspect here, is that there is back reaction, and it's very different from semi-classical gravity, where you just take an expectation value, and have a gravitational field. For example, in semi-classical gravity, you don't have a distribution of gravitational fields, and there is no way to go back. So, but here you have that, yeah. So this is it's similar to the measurement case that Michael discussed before me, in that you have then the uncertainty in both worlds, and you have back reaction. This is what I was mentioning. What you get here is a theory that's fundamentally different from semi-classical gravity. So this is of interest because there's a lot of known problems with semi-classical gravity. And here we can explore some other alternative. And the difficult part, of course, is that you get very ugly equations that are nonlinear functional differential equations. And they're very hard to solve. What I'm going to show you here is a calculation where you can get results. And what I've done here is I've considered a hybrid model where I go to spherically symmetric gravity. Okay, so it's still a field theory. It's not a mini superspace model. It's a midi superspace model where you assume spherical symmetry. And what you get is instead of the six components of the metric, you just get two fields, this capital lambda and capital R. And that's your configuration space. And you can do what I did before, and you write an ensemble Hamiltonian for classical gravity with a quantized scalar field, where everything is spherically symmetric. And it's quite horrible. It's you get something that's hard to solve. I just want to show you the form of it. This part here is the classical part. And this part here is the Fisher information part that comes from the fluctuations. The classical part looks like this, where the pure gravity part is here, and it looks like that. And this is a potential term that's essentially the Ricci scalar for the three-dimensional space. And this is here the quantum potential, the term that the non-classical term. But it turns out that you can get a solution for these equations, making some rather stringent assumptions. And the assumptions are, I'm not going to look for a general solution. It's hopeless. But I'm going to look for a solution that's valid for a particular type of foliation. And here, this goes back to what I was telling about the importance of representing the Hamilton-Jacobi equations as an integral of the lattice function with respect to this Hamilton-Jacobi equation. For arbitrary n, you get a general solution that's very hard to find. But if I choose a lattice function that is constant, and I also choose a foliation of spaces of constant positive curvature, then I get solutions that simplify tremendously. This is an approach that I learned from a paper by Klaus Kiefer, where he was looking at an expansion of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And I've tested it with other problems where you can find an exact solution for black hole spacetimes. And it works. So I have confidence that this it gives you a particular solution, but it's a solution that works. And what I will do is take an extreme case where my function S is zero, so essentially I have a static case. And for the probability that essentially has to do with the field, I will take what is equivalent in quantum field theory to a ground state Gaussian functional of C. Okay? And if I do this, then I get a very special solution, but the problem reduces to one of solving for the ground state of a quantized scalar field in an Einstein universe. So one shouldn't make too many general conclusions from this particular solution. One really needs to go and look for perturbative solutions here that are more and more general than what I'm doing here. But I wanted to show this anyway. I recently put a preprint in the server, did that on Friday, where I described the details of this calculation in case anybody is interested. But what comes out of it is that you end up with a static solution, and it's essentially an Einstein universe, of course, because you have spherical symmetry and you have a static solution. And in the classical Einstein universe, you need a cosmological constant that is effectively a repulsive force that balances the matter so that you get a static solution. In this case, what you end up is with an equation that is extremely complicated because you need to renormalize. That is, you map the problem to a quantum field in a curved spacetime. And to get a finite solution, you need to renormalize. That has been done for a long time. And I could just take a result from the literature. But after you renormalize, then an equation that appeared to be simple before but gave you infinite results is now includes a function alpha, which is a complicated function of the mass associated with a quantized field and of the radius of the universe. And you get a very rich class of solutions. Now, this caught me a bit by surprise, and part of it is that one is used to seeing mini superspace solutions, where there is no issue of renormalization. And that's how you work a lot of problems in quantum gravity and quantum cosmology. But this calculation, of course, is simpler than that because we keep the gravitational field classical. This seems to indicate that the approximation of mini superspace is really very severe, because if you don't do that, then issue of renormalization makes your solution very, very rich. And this is a very rich solution that, in some cases, requires a cosmological constant to get a solution. But for other values of the mass, you don't require a cosmological constant. That is, it turns out that the quantum field itself can balance the tendency to collapse. What is not clear is whether these are stable solutions or not. Again, one really needs to go to this set of equations, find an approximate solution that allows for time evolution, doesn't give you necessarily the static Einstein universe. And then you can then test that. Another thing that comes out of the solution, which is interesting, is that even though we have a classical gravitational field in a quantized matter field, the radius of the universe ends up being quantized. That is, you can, I did this for the ground state wave functional, but you can also do it for excited states. And that's what you get then is different energies of a quantized state that are discrete. And this brings in, or as a consequence of the fact that the quantized field has to have some discrete levels, we're in a closed universe, that the radius of the universe also takes discrete values. And this is quite nice. I mean, it shows you that you can get this type of effects even in a mixed classical quantum theory. As I say, the details of the calculations are on this preprint that's on the server. And I'm running out of time, so I think I'll just go to the conclusions. One of the conclusions is that this approach that Michael described for particles does allow you to reconstruct quantum theory for fields, and that is quite nice. For bosonic fields that are quadratic in there, with kinetic energy that's quadratic in the momenta. As Michael emphasized also, it's not a full reconstruction in that we take as our starting point the classical theory. But as an alternative way of quantization, it's interesting that it translates without much technical difficulties into fields. What you have here in this case is that the non-classical fluctuations are added to the functional derivative of S. And what I think is valuable, but one really has to evaluate to what extent this is a real advantage or is it just an illusion, is that we have essentially a Hamilton-Jacobi quantization. That is, we don't have to go through a phase space, and we don't have to go an algebra of operators on phase space. And in the late 60s, there was some activity in relativity trying to look at ways of doing Hamilton-Jacobi quantization. This sort of completes that program that Peter Bergman and Arthur Komen were working on by introducing the exact uncertainty approach. This is the one element that allows you then to go to the quantum theory. That was missing in the previous. And the other thing that is of interest is that since if you play around with the formalism, you learn that you can do essentially a partial quantization and couple classical gravity to quantum fields. You can formulate a theory and try to find solutions of these hybrid systems, which hopefully will help you understand better what to expect of a full theory of gravity and see what the limitations are of such a mixed theory. Finally, the theory that you get is really different from semi-classical gravity, so this provides an alternative to that. And that's it, essentially. Thank you. Yeah, one can. One reason I use this spherically symmetric formalism is that I've been looking at black hole spacetime in this spherically symmetric Midi superspace, and there one has a classical theory, Hamilton-Jacobi theory, that one can solve in closed form. So it's quite nice, and one can have described black holes with charge, and also with a cosmological constant in the spacetime. This is work that goes back to the 80s. But one can use that as a starting point to then try to look at what happens when we add quantized fields using this formalism. And once you add some matter fields, then it becomes messy, then it's not quite nice. But hopefully one can find then perturbative solutions and look at things. For example, one thing that would be very nice to look at, but technically looks very difficult, is black hole evaporation. In this formalism, your spacetime is always assumed to be classical, and you should be able to continue up to the point of evaporation without things breaking down, at least from the mathematics. You should. I mean, technically, it looks horribly difficult. So, but this is one type of thing that one can study here. I don't know if that's what you were mentioning. Yeah, because also you have back reactions, so you can, of course, yeah, the back reaction is crucial here. So you can, since the formalism has that, then you can hopefully get some. This is a 3+1 approach, yeah.
So, one might imagine that there'd be something in quantum gravity akin to quantum superposition, but involving different kinds. Rather than just having, say, a superposition, something like a superposition of different spatial geometries at a single time.
Yeah.
Something which involves some sort of superposition corresponding to different times, so that in particular, the question of whether or not a particular interval is space-like or time-like wouldn't be well defined in the same way that.
No, I don't think it's ruled out. One of the nice things of starting from a Hamilton-Jacobi formulation is that it's fully gauge invariant. So you don't fix a foliation, and you don't fix any of the lattice vectors and stuff like that. If you're lucky enough to find a solution to this equation here that's valid for arbitrary, so if you find a solution that satisfies infinity of constraints here. So I can imagine that if you have a solution that doesn't care about lattice functions, then you can consider basically different foliations. You can null foliations or space-like foliations and things like that. What will happen for this particular case where I am coupling classical gravity to quantum matter fields is a bit more, it's a bit harder to guess, really. One would expect that since the field remains classical, space-time remains classical, that certain things are much better defined than if you assume that everything is quantum. So what you will have, though, is uncertainties in how you describe the gravitational fields on a particular slice. That is, since you have a probability distributions over the metrics, the three metrics, then I can envision a situation where the uncertainty might be so large for a particular question that you're asking that you cannot give a good answer, basically. So what I'm saying is that rather than coming into a contradiction, you will have a situation where you don't make a definitive prediction. So it's a bit like saying, well, in quantum mechanics, we have the uncertainty relation. So if there's some questions you just can't ask because the state is in a momentum eigenstate, the position is completely spread out, and it resolves certain type of apparent paradoxes. I can imagine that the same thing will happen here, where in some configuration of the quantum field, you end up with such a uncertainty in the classical gravitational field that some question that you ask might just be subject to a huge uncertainty. Whether it's so you don't blurry the light cone,
yeah,
basically.
You're not allowing yourself to be something.
Well, I don't think that will be the case. I don't really know the answer, but I can imagine situations where you have a light cone structure. For given a solution of the Einstein equations, you have a light cone structure. A different solution will have a light construction where the light cones are oriented slightly different. So for example, a black hole solution, depending on the mass. For example, if you have a black hole with a given mass, then you have a certain light construction. Then if you increase the mass, then the light construction closes in more and things like that. If you have uncertainty in the classical space-time that you're dealing with, this would translate essentially in having uncertainty on this light cone structure. And since a light cone structure is what tells you what is space like and what is time like, here this would mean that you can ask certain questions, but the uncertainty of where the light cone is going to be too large to be able to say, oh, this is definitely space like or time like. This is what I would expect that you would find. Well, for all the questions, you will find out that, okay, we have a sharp distribution of space times, and from here to here is definitely space-like. But your point is well made, that since we are working in a 3+1 foliation, I'm not entirely sure how that plays out. I mean, this reconstruction that I did for the purely classical case, where am I? No, I'm way back. I pointed out that by interpreting this as a continuity equation, you can get the remaining six Einstein equations, and then you have the full space-time. And then you can forget that you started from a foliation. This still goes through in the if you keep the gravitational field classical. This is a deterministic, yeah. So for a particular choice of H, then you get this evolution equation. So these are the six.
In a deterministic case, it doesn't really matter because there will be a definite solution as to what the metric is important. So there will exist foliations.
Right. Yeah, but you're thinking of a statistical case in a four-dimensional space-time already, because this is a statistical case in a three-dimensional.
Where you interacting here, but for the whole system distribution?
Yeah, I don't know to what extent you, yes, it goes back to the conversation we had earlier. I'm being cowardly here and trying not to deal with the issue of ontology and taking a point of view that you don't, at this level of the equations, you don't really have to force an ontology onto the theory. I might be wrong about that, and maybe it already includes an ontology. By emphasizing the fact that we have probability distributions, I'm saying, well, we have probability distributions, and whether we give it a certain ontological interpretation or another, I won't worry about it at this point. So I'm not sure that we are forcing an ontology here, but it might be the case that it's...
I guess so one has to ask where these probabilities come from. Like, are they probabilities that come from some function, or are they like God probabilities? You know, they seem to be from outside. If you have a system, for example, of universes, and that will kind of get the more ontological notion. And I think what you're doing is more consistent. If it's more in that thing, then it is from
inside. No, I'm thinking more in terms for example, I did one toy model where I took a two-dimensional gravity using Nordstrom theory of gravity. It's not a proper theory of gravity, is on Minkowski space, but it has a lot of nice properties. And what I wanted to look at is the interaction of a classical gravitational wave with a quantized scalar field. So that's in a paper that came out last year. And what you can do is find a solution along the lines of what I showed you before, where in the limit of no interaction, you have the two theories, and then you bring in an interaction, and then you have some sort of. And there, my thought was that, one of the main results is that even if you start with a gravitational field that is a delta function, you know exactly what it is, after it interacts with the quantum system, which has uncertainty, you get uncertainty. And I was thinking of that example more as something that somebody could go and measure the gravity. But of course, here I'm doing cosmology, so you're absolutely right about that, and it's something I hadn't really wondered about how one should handle this. Perhaps one has all the problems that one has with quantum cosmology, and even in this hybrid approach. I haven't really thought about it, but it's something to worry about.
Yeah, that would be one way of making it concrete. Yeah. Making it clear what kind of interpretation problems you can do.
It's interesting to try to
see
what else you can track and measure a whole frequency.
Yeah, yeah.
A whole field.
No, this is a problem. I mean, is the notion simply more invariant and it's not clear? So you're even if a problem is over observable constants, the problem is
You mean whether the formalism is diffeomorphism invariant, or?
Well, we have assessed whether your problem is with respect to diffeomorphism invariant quantities.
I mean, the formalism is diffeomorphism invariant. The Hamilton-Jacobi equation is diffeomorphism invariant. It doesn't look like it so much because it's written here on a particular time slice. But if you find a general solution that is valid for every lapsed function, then you get something that's diffeomorphism invariant. And you have the 10 Einstein, once you add these equations to it, then you have the 10 Einstein equations in space-time, and you can forget about the lap. So in that sense, it's the same as the Hamiltonian formulation of gravity. It's a constraint system, but it is these constraints that give you at the end, diffeomorphism invariant. Even.
Can you talk a bit about how, given that technical fact, can you talk about how that plays out when you try to interpret what the probability means?
No, these are, well, I haven't. These are probabilities defined on the hypersurface, because that's your configuration space, so the metric on the hypersurface. But I guess in this, I don't know how it plays out. If you go from the hypersurface to the full space, and then you go back to a different hypersurface, whether you get inconsistencies or not. I think that is the question that you're asking. I mean, my tendency is to believe, no, there's no reason why you should get inconsistencies. That is, you will get a different probability distribution, but essentially you're going to a different configuration space once you choose a different. I don't exactly know where the consistency conditions are. Since you can reconstruct it's something to think about, because the probability here is a new element. And as far as S is concerned, there is certainly no problem. The whole formalism of Hamilton-Jacobi is diffeomorphism invariant, and you can go to different slices. But I haven't put careful thought if you have problems with P. Well, there's also the technical issue that you have to factor out the gauge group when you're dealing with this probability. So you really, your expressions are really you have to divide out this, and it becomes, of course, complicated. But yeah, well, usually you just go to the mini superspace model too. Yeah, and then you don't have these issues. Yeah, but this is something that one might investigate in this black hole space times, because there, as I say, you can get a closed form for S, and then it should be possible to see what happens to. So then you have a solution that's valid for every possible foliation. There you have it in closed form, which is very nice. And then you could examine this issue of looking at different foliations. The different foliations amount to choosing different forms of the Schwarzschild metric. So either you get the traditional one, or you get it in Lemaitre coordinates or some other coordinates. But this could be investigated then. So that's a good, very good point.
Any more questions? Thank you.